So you had an MB 2 days ago, is that possible? In Vladimir Medishinguda, is that possible? Were you down there?
Exactly, yes.
I saw you in the bonfire, I was coming in and you were going out. So do you live in San Francisco?
No, we live in Chattanooga.
Oh wow, really? My dad's from Lawrenceburg. Yeah.
That's quite amazing actually, because when we came yesterday we went to pick up a Tibetan man from the airport, and then there's a street here, it's called Chattanooga Streets, and he said, "What name is that? Is that English?"
Indeed. I said, "I don't know, Native American."
He comes from the Native American.
Yeah, yeah.
Mm-hmm. What does it mean?
Do you know?
Some meaning?
I'm sure it has a meaning, but whether or not we know it, yeah.
I actually grew up here.
Oh, in San Francisco.
Yeah, Fulton.
Yeah, okay. Anyway, so for those who don't know me, my name is Anivita, and I've been a nun since 91. Most of that time actually living in Dharamsala. Tushita is a center which is very much, you know, like it's the same organization as this one. Very quickly, when you live up there, they ask you to teach, even if you don't want to. because there's such great demand, right? It's like so many tourists come to Dharamsala, and then they see the Tibetans, they're very inspired, and they think, you know, when they see their smiling faces and their patience and how they are and how they behave, the older ones, yeah, then they think that, oh, that's great, I wonder how they got to be like that, so maybe I want to do this as well. And then, you know, because the Tibetans seem to kind of effortlessly manifest patience, wisdom, compassion, and so it looks as if for them everything is kind of easy. Maybe we should start recording that, because this has to do what we're doing today. So when people see the Tibetans, yeah, so then they get very inspired. But you see the Tibetans, they kind of never complain or don't complain much, and they don't brag also. So they never really say how hard it was and how much time it took them to develop this mind which is patience, love, compassion, wisdom. Yeah. So when we see the result, and then us, you know, our society who wants to have everything right now, it's quite amazing how quickly then one can get discouraged. Because of course it's like with everything else, yeah, the more effort you put into something, the more you get out of it. And if it's just so, if it's little effort, then there's little result. There's still a result, but it's little result. If you put a lot of effort, then there's big result. Yeah. So I think the way the Tibetans grew up also, you know, in Tibet, very little comfort. Very few material things. Landscapes kind of completely empty. Yeah. No magazines, novels, books, TV, movies, DVDs, MP3 players, computers, email, you know, all those things that are made to make our lives easier and more comfortable, and so that we can be happier, isn't it? All those things that we have. So they had none of it. Yet if we look, it looks as they are happier than we are. I don't know, you know. So this is another thing that sometimes we have to check. All the things that we have, own, possess, is it really doing the job that, you know, why it was invented? It was invented, it was created or produced in order to make people happier, I think, you know. I don't think even people who make those things and want to sell them, I don't think their motivation is just to sell their products. Because otherwise, I mean, nobody is so stupid kind of thinking that, yeah, if they know, if I just think about myself, then very difficult to sell something. If I want to sell something, I have to think about customers. Yeah? So the customer doesn't buy the things just to spend money. The customer buys the things because they think there's some happiness in there. So the motivation is kind of mixed, you know, from people who make those things. And definitely behind all this stands the wish to be happier, to be more relaxed, to have more peace. It just doesn't work, that's all. Yeah, because it's looking in the wrong way. So then the tourists who are in Dharamsala, and then they see the Tibetans, and then they get interested. So from Tushita, who was actually a retreat center when I first got there, we had very few courses. It changed into a course center. From the retreat center, it changed into a meditation center, a course center. And we do two intro to Buddhism courses twice a month, 10 days each. And we have about 80 people in each course, and sometimes you have to refuse people. So this is why I said, you know, then there's always the shortest teachers. So then, of course, I hoped that, because I didn't think I was ready. I became a nun because I wanted to study, I wanted to practice, because I could see the value of it. I didn't become a nun or a Buddhist because I wanted to teach. That was absolutely not my intention. So when I was first asked, so with great hopes, I went to see my teacher, and I really hoped that he would say no, that no, you're not ready, this is too early, whatever. But then he said yes. So this is the beauty of having a teacher, having somebody that you really trust, that even though you do feel inadequate and you think you can't do it, when they say yes, you just go ahead and do it, no matter what it is, actually. And this helps us to stretch our borders. It really helps. So this is why, you know, if you do want to do practice, it's always stressed that the importance of a teacher. Now, of course, as a beginner, you do not need a personal teacher. But then, let's say, for the first 2-3 years, if you really practice in depth, or like study a lot, first 2-3 years, so that you have a good overview of what this is all about, that's okay. But after 2-3 years, and you really want to go deeper into your practices, you see that you start having problems. Because why? Because there are so many practices. So how do you know what's good for you? Are you going off and just training a concentrated mind? Will you first do purifications, as the Tibetans do? Will you do studies? Will you do work? How do we know? You know, those are the things that usually one... All of this we can call practice, by the way. Anything can be a practice. We practice every day. What is our most common practice? What do we practice every day? Huh? What was that?
Attachment.
Sleeping. Attachment, right, attachment. That is our most common practice. The question comes like kind of, when do we call something a practice? What is a practice? You won't get the answer from me. You'll have to. You'll have to help me. Peter, yeah.
Well, I was going to let someone else talk, but something.
Sure.
Don't get me going. Something that you do in a concentrated way every day.
Okay, something you do in a concentrated way every day. That could be called a practice. What else makes an activity a practice? Think of the word practice.
Okay.
Oh, she was just about to answer the question, what is it? What makes a practice? And now, and she was very timidly holding up her hand. Now she might have the perfect excuse.
It's a practice because you're not perfect.
Right. Is that what you wanted to say?
Yes.
Yeah. It's very true, you know. It, like, practicing means you understand that there's something there that needs to be developed, on one hand. Or practice means, like, as Peter says, doing something in a very concentrated way. Why? Because there's a goal, because there's something that we want to attain. Yeah. So some of you, I know your faces, also I've seen you last week, so then I know that you are probably coming here pretty regularly. Some others of you I don't know. So, I mean, here we will mostly talk about Buddhist practices, so if you're not a Buddhist, please do not feel upset. You know, that we'll talk about, you know, practicing like your hair is on fire, meaning practice is not so much practices how to get more money. It's also a practice, right? We go to school and we have all those study programs, how to be more clever so that you can cheat people and they buy your stuff. And if it works and you're employed, you get your salary kind of goes up. So that's a practice. Then we have sports practices, right? Where you learn to be a Wimbledon champion or whatever, you know, skier or what do you have, a cyclist, right? Like Landis, he had to practice very, very hard in order to be able to run the Tour de France the way he does, plus all the others, so that's also practice. Yeah. And then, so this is this whole thing, you know, with the practice. At the beginning of each practice is faith. You know, when we hear the word faith, then for us faith is something like, well, a god or a religion or something that I don't understand, so therefore I have to have faith. It's not like that. At the beginning of each practice, be it the economic practice where you want to earn more money, be it the sports practice, be it the being more beautiful, being whatever, there's faith. What kind of faith? Microphone. Maybe I'll learn also and then I'll practice a bit.
That the practice will work for you, is that you'll develop something where right. You can achieve that
exactly.
Desire.
Yeah. And even, you know, even more subtle than that, like underneath that, just attaining the goal for the sake of the goal.
That it will make you happy.
That it will make you happy. And I think that's like, you know, that's with everybody. Because then, now, if you have very small aspirations, because what does faith do? Faith gives us aspiration. If you have aspiration, we can make effort. If we make effort, we will get the result. Yeah. So actually in Buddhist practice, it's those five things that you really need, and then it goes in those steps, right? First you have to have faith. Then that gives you aspiration. So if you count aspiration as well, then that's six. With that, you can make effort. You will make effort, spontaneously. Yeah. Then with effort, you will develop what is called mindfulness. Because without mindfulness, your practice will be very, very unstable. And the Buddhist practice, of course, is to realize emptiness, to see things as they are and not to stop believing in that they exist the way that they appear. The practice, the goal of the practice is to cut through ignorance, to be free from all suffering. So you see, actually, the Buddhist practice is not so much to have more happiness. What is the Buddhist practice? Oh, you're nodding. Are you sure? Because that's what we're looking for. You see, we're looking for more happiness, and this is one of our biggest mistakes that we're making. This is why it's so difficult for us to practice something. Then when it doesn't come immediately, we kind of, oh, it doesn't work. It doesn't work quick enough. What is the goal? It's almost the same, but it's not quite the same. Same but different. You know, like the Heart Sutra? Same but different.
Is it enlightenment?
Yeah, but try to be not just words. Try to be more specific. Try to give the terms more substance so that we can really understand. You have to say that into the microphone.
To be in the now?
To be in the now.
At the very moment.
Okay. That's one goal. But again, why? Why to be in the now? Why not to be lost in thoughts all the time? We have to invent the cordless microphone.
So that we can help others.
So we can help others. That would be the Mahayana motivation. But the very, very kind of very basic, what lies underneath channel?
No, I think it's to be free from suffering.
Right. To have less suffering. Yeah, so when we practice, we look for more happiness. So when whatever kind of hinders that happiness now, then we think the practice is not working. What we should be looking for is less suffering. Because that's what the Four Noble Truths are all about. The Four Noble Truths, it doesn't say anything about happiness in the Four Noble Truths. Yeah? It says, the first noble truth is like, understand your existence to be sufferings. And not just a very gross suffering of pain, but the suffering of like this kind of our existence is unstable, how everything always falls apart, but how we have a mind that wants happiness and grasps. Whenever there is a pleasant moment, we grasp. We want to, you know, make it more intense by not seeing that it's not in the nature of our existence to be stable. It's not in the nature of our existence for things to last. Very unstable. But we want to have control, and then we freak out. See, if we let go of wanting to be in control, we freak out much less. All the fears and the anxieties that we have come from because we think we are in control, or we want to be in control. I mean, it was amazing. I don't know if you've heard, my teacher, Kirtsen Rinpoche, he was in Israel just now, then he was diagnosed with incurable liver cancer last week. So I mentioned that because we recite the King of Prayers for him, and I was giving a talk about mindfulness to some like kind of normal students, but then also there was a, like it was an LMB, so we have those groups which are called elder hostels. Yeah, so it's like they're quite nice actually. They're people which are above 80 and still interested in spiritual practices, having worked with their mind and this and that. So some of them have an incredible sense of humor, are very sharp, very funny, and really a great pleasure to be with. So this is the kind of old people I would like to be like that when I'm old. But there's no guarantee because there's very few of those. See, again, to have contact with a group of, I don't think, because for them it's okay to say old people. For them. For many old people, it's not okay to say old people. You have to say elderly people. The same thing. Doesn't take any years away if you say old or elderly, or it doesn't make you, you know, add anything if you say old. But so many old, I don't want to be old. And some there also, they don't like this word, but for most of them it's okay. So I said that, but then next morning, really one person came and said, why cancer? I mean, she said, I was so disturbed to hear that a clear mind like this can have cancer. And I said, exactly. Exactly, that's why. So he shows us that no matter how clear your mind is, you still have a body that is unstable, impermanent, full of suffering, and can get anything. You see this whole thing again, we think we do spiritual practices, then we should have a healthy body. Healthy body very much depends on past karma. And then when I discussed with her, discussed, I said, anyway, why are you disturbed, kind of, because it's like, he took it in an incredibly good way. He said he was very happy to hear that he has cancer. He's very happy to hear that it's incurable, so he doesn't have to run from one place to the other. Funny enough, I'm a bit the same. I'm always happy when I have something and people there's nothing you can do, because then I know I can be loved. I have really bad back problems, and all the doctors, I think we talked about this last time already, yeah? I went to see 4 doctors in different parts of the world because I'm traveling a lot. I had 4 completely different opinions what's wrong with my back. And one definitely wanted to operate. So I went to see my teacher, he said, whatever, but don't operate. It will just make it worse. It will be okay, better at the beginning, but then it will get worse in the long run. Then you know. And then you relax. And it's much better since then, actually. I stopped paying too much attention. I stopped worrying about it. I know that I can't control it. I know, you know, I don't have to think, oh, maybe I should have it operated and this and that. And then I give the mind the opportunity to get used to it because it doesn't get better. It's not this constant up, down, up, down, up, down, up, down. If you, it's quite amazing to see how we can get used to our suffering. Suffering creates less suffering than pleasure, by the way. Yeah? Because pleasure is like, every time pleasure comes, you go, ah, you know, we think it's going to last. And every time it goes, we're disappointed. So anyway, so he said that he was quite happy. He thought the doctor was incredibly kind to look after him so well. He was more concerned about the doctor and the nurses and about himself. He was in Haifa Hospital when the bombs were falling. Just today, a week ago. He was in Haifa, in Israel, and the city was attacked. And while the doctor was about to take his biopsy, they had to go down to the shelter. And the people said, like, Rinpoche, his attendants, and his translator, they were the only ones smiling because they were saying mantras. Everybody was really kind of peaceful. And then when they came back up, then again the sirens went off, but then the doctor said, let's pull this through, although I know this is illegal, I should go down with it, but let's just do it. And so they did it. And Rinpoche started to cheer everybody up by telling stories, but in a very humorous way, how he escaped Tibet. But then he looked up and he said, well, it wasn't as bad as that, and burst out laughing. Then he's back in India now, and he said he wants to go back to his monastery. And he left, like 2 days later he left, at 3:30 in the morning from Tel Aviv airport. And some people went there, of course, to say goodbye. And one of them sent me an email saying, he must have the mind of an ox. Because having been diagnosed with incurable liver cancer 2 days ago, like, you know, he's very frail, he's very thin, he's quite old, and so he had to fast for the biopsy and all that, so he was quite weak. But she said, and he waved at us, he smiled at us, he assured us how he was okay, that we didn't have to worry, whatever, and this is 3:30 in the morning, she said, you know, and before a journey to India. And I wrote back, I'm not sure if ox can do that. Smile at 3:30 in the morning in the airport, I don't think so. But I said, how about the mind of the Buddha? Or the mind of a realized being? Who knows? It's just the body. And the body, you know, the body dies. So the body needs conditions to die. Yeah? So actually what he said when he found out is, at least now I can do proper Tonglen. Tonglen meaning taking the suffering of others and giving all your happiness, because he says now it becomes real. Before it was just theory, it was just words. You know, if you hear that from an ordinary being, you say, oh, they give up, they should try, they should fight, they should do this, they should do that. Well, Buddhist philosophy is like, you have another life, right? So, and you have to die anyway. So it's like, the moment we really know, and this doesn't go for Rinpoche, this goes for us, yeah? Like, the moment we really know that we don't have that much time left, then we will finally sit down and practice properly. Because getting more money, no point. Yeah? Getting more health, no point. Getting more beauty, no point. Getting a bigger house, no point. Getting a better car, no point. But until we realize that we are going to die, maybe a new car will make me happy. Maybe a new partner will make me happy. Maybe a better house. Maybe another job. Maybe, you know, this is, if you really look at our thoughts, me included, yeah, most of our time goes into planning. How can I have a better body, a better situation, have more comfort? Sometimes even better partner, better for me, maybe better friends, better people to practice with. You know, it doesn't matter. We're all the same. Just because I have no hair and wear those clothes, it doesn't make me anything realized with. It's the same. Maybe, okay, the thoughts are not into better car and better this and better that and better that, but the thoughts are into better people to practice with, for example. You know, better environment to practice. It's always this, you know. There's always something that seems to hinder us here and now so that we can finally sit down and practice. Whereas when we do get an incurable sickness, then if we accept it, that will give us this aspiration. Because then we have to send the faith that having better things around us so that we can be happier with it, that there will be less suffering, that's gone. So the faith goes somewhere else, right? And then the faith gives us the aspiration to practice. So, you know, I'm usually I thought I would be devastated if I hear those news, yeah, that my teacher will probably not be in his body for that much longer. But you don't know with those things. That's the other thing. The doctors who are not Buddhist, they're scientists, right? Even they said, like, look, we don't even want to make a kind of prediction or prognosis how much longer he will have to live. Because he said, because he is very special. It's impossible to say how long he will live for somebody like this. So even they saw kind of things. And also when the bombs started falling, they said, we'll go to Rinpoche's room and he'll take refuge there. The doctors and the nurses. Everybody wanted to treat him. Like, people were saying that there was an island of peace in this madness, which is now in northern Israel and in Lebanon at the moment, and it's so terrible. So horrible. But there was this peace, this island of peace around Rinpoche. Because he was not afraid. So that's another thing. If you have liver cancer, you know, you can't go, well, if I die now in 6 months, it's a big difference. It's true, you know. I mean, how many years have we already lived? Once they're gone, once they're finished, what's the difference? You see what I mean with that stuff? But now, please, yeah, don't go to Golden Gate Bridge and jump off. Suicide's not a good thing. This is considered a very negative act. You know, it's not, I'm not afraid of death, therefore I'm going to kill myself. That's not what it's meant here. Also, death doesn't make you go to a higher state immediately. Or just dying doesn't solve any problems whatsoever. And I have to mention that because in one course, actually, unfortunately, really, really bad, somebody, and we don't know whether she jumped off the roof or she fell off the roof, that was in India, so it could have been suicide, having this view that dying makes you go to a higher state. So absolutely not, especially not if you jump. So don't even think like this would be a solution. It's absolutely no solution because it creates a lot of suffering around you. There's a lot of guilt, a lot of, oh, should have done that, should have said that, should have done, like from my side, yeah, should have heard what she said in a better way. Because I kind of knew that she got it wrong and I did try to clarify, but of course, if you're clairvoyant and you know there's the danger of her doing that, then you spend much more time with her than just saying, look, dying is not getting you to a better state. So don't. Okay, promise? Okay. Right. So now the big question is, you know, do we have faith? So where is our faith that gives us the aspiration that then makes effort easy? So that then we can have mindfulness, concentration, and wisdom. This is that kind of the path. And we can go backwards. Without concentration, no wisdom of seeing reality as it is. Because the factor of wisdom, that we, it's a mental factor of wisdom that we have, intelligence that we have in our mind stream. So for those who study Lorik, mind and mental factors, okay, you might have come across that one. It's one of the ascertaining factors, like we have omnipresent factors and then the five ascertaining factors. So it's actually those five, faith, effort, mindfulness, concentration, and wisdom. So those in those states. And without faith, yeah, so without concentration there's no wisdom. Without mindfulness there's no concentration. Mindfulness means, you know, not just being present. Mindfulness is really having an object of concentration, and you are mindful that the mind is not there, that you know your object of meditation, you are aware, you're mindful that your mind is not there, and you bring it back again and again and again and again. Mindfulness is also discipline, ethical discipline. Being mindful that we are about to do, what we are about to do or to say or to think is getting us to the lower state. Is not getting us anywhere where we want to be, a state that has less effort. Then without effort, no mindfulness, because our mindfulness is not effortless, right? At the moment we have to apply, we have to squeeze the mind almost to, you know, to stay there. like a little puppy, you know, if you don't apply some kind of effortful discipline, like, you know, you have to be firm with your puppy and repeat again and again and again and again and again and again and again. Now with the puppy, the faith is that it will stop making people cut out the room. Yes, but this is usually what we train the puppies for, because it's unpleasant, it's suffering, doesn't smell good, it's like a mess. So the mess that we want to clean up is our afflictive emotions by having recognized that these are the ones who create the suffering. That it's not the Israeli-Lebanon war at the moment, it's not the Iraq war, it's not the pollution, it's not the war, the global warming, that's just the condition. Yeah. And I think what Rinpoche was manifesting is Kipi Tenshi Rinpoche, by the way, some of you might have met him. So yeah, what I wanted to say, I thought I would be devastated by hearing those news, but by what he manifests, you know, it's so inspiring. It's so inspiring. I'm still waiting for the breakdown, and it's coming. It will probably come. Because as I said, you know, it's thanks to Kitsenja Rinpoche that I am what I am right now. It's thanks to him that I'm able to maybe share the little knowledge that I have, because me, from my side, I would never have enough self-confidence to sit in front of people and tell them what to do. Definitely not. But then, losing somebody like this is quite a good thing, because whenever there is a doubt, should I do this or should I do that, because there are so many different things to do, you just go and clarify, even with body stuff, you know, like you have four opinions from four different voices, you don't know what to do, and you just go and ask Rinpoche and do it all. And then they see. Yeah, so the pain is still there, but they're right. Whereas if there's this kind of, what shall I do, you know, these constant doubts that kind of plague us, because we're not clairvoyant. We don't know when we make a choice, we don't know if that was the good choice. If we make a choice, we don't know if that was the better choice than the other one, because the other one we didn't do it, so if we don't know how this would have gone with that choice. So we don't know, you know. It might seem when we choose something that this was the better choice to make, or the worst choice to make. We don't say the bad, the worst choice to make. We think we know, but we don't, because we don't know what would have happened if we would have gone that way. Okay, yeah. So then this is why, if you really want to practice now attaining enlightenment, like the Buddhist practice, like eliminating all our own suffering, and then, as you said, you know, having a mind that is so big that we are able to benefit all others, not just some others, but all others, not all others at the same time. You know, this is what people misunderstand sometimes also, and then they freak out. How can I benefit all others? Doesn't mean like all others at the same time. It means all others having a mind which is equanimous, and whomever you can benefit, you don't choose. You say, oh, this one deserves my help, but this one, no, this one's a bad guy, I'm not going to help him or her. Yeah. So that's the word there, benefit all others. Because we also have to realize, recognize, no matter how much we want to benefit, it also depends on the other person's karma, whether our benefit or our help will bring some positive result. And there again, we don't have clairvoyance. This is why we have to practice more with our own mind first, because the wish to benefit others is definitely there. This is a very human thing that we have. This is, I think, why also the human rebirth is so precious, because there's this normal wish to benefit in general, when we are well. Yeah? When our mind is peaceful and open, then the wish comes quite spontaneous, isn't it? And we're very happy when we're able to benefit in some way. But because our skills are so small, and we're so result-oriented, then, and we can't see into the future what we just did now, is it going to be a benefit, is it going to be a harm, whatever. So this is why it's very important that we work on our own mind, because we can maybe in short terms it looks like benefiting others, long terms it might be harming them, because we take away from them the opportunity to grow up, to create merit. Mm-hmm. Helping somebody with money all the time, that's just, you know, temporarily help. But then walking away and not giving any money and saying, oh, that's not going to help, that's not good either.
Yeah.
But maybe trying to have to, and I'm not talking about the homeless kind of spaces, if we can't solve that problem anyway, we ourselves. But we should have a wish to be able to really benefit them, to really help them. But some of them are so far gone that, you know, how can you benefit in the long term? I think the best way to benefit them is to be kind. So that when, the same as with us, when you meet with kindness, your heart also opens. You don't feel threatened. You don't feel attacked. So your heart opens, so you have a moment of peace, even if you are very poor. That's the best way to benefit. And when their heart is open, then they can also be kind to others. If their heart is not open and they're very aggressive, how can they be kind to others? By being kind to others, they create some merit, which then in the future will ripen as not being homeless. Or if you want, kind of, if you really want, another good way of benefiting is, like Lama Dzogchen Rinpoche, you know, when people approach him in the street or they ask him for money, he always gives. And he gives big amounts. And we are around and going like, maybe not so good. He does, man. He just gives. You ask, that's the sign of a bodhisattva, you know? We're always thinking, oh, I'm not sure if that's good or not good. But we're not really honest when we do that, you know, because we don't know whether it's good or not. How can we know anyway? So as an excuse we have, well, it's just making them dependent, you know? That's the excuse, but underneath it's that I don't want to give. Because why? Because I'm too stingy. If we really look and if we're very honest, you know, that's usually our, but we cover it with this kind of, oh, it's not skillful, because it's true it's not skillful. Yeah. But you see, I don't know Lama Dzogchen's mind. I don't know why he gives this like this in abundance. To me, sometimes it looks a bit unskillful, but you know, who am I to say? But I noticed that giving in abundance, and we did that when we went to distribute the things from the Mine, like 2 years ago. We went to, we had like a huge amount of offering, like 9 or 8 in the shopping bags full of food. So I thought we're going to distribute, give it, distribute first, yeah? That was my thought. Distribute it to the homeless. And then we couldn't find any. That's so funny. Santa Cruz, so we, you know, there we are, like, with the bags in our hands, because usually they're always around, yeah? Couldn't find anybody. So then we go back into the car, we start cruising around, and then finally found one. We kind of went, yep, this is this whole thing. You can see the practice also. The mind who wants to give is looking for somebody who needs something. If we walk through the street with the mind not wanting to give, we get disturbed by those people. Yeah. But when we had so much stuff, we needed more than one anyway. So I said to the person, I said, stop! So I ran out. And ran after the person and said, please come. And we opened the booth, you know, and then there was all those bags. And I said, please choose. Because, you know, because there was so much. And there was no danger of them, you know, if there's 10 jumping into the booth and fighting or something like that, which is very odd, unpleasant. I'm used to that from India. Yeah. But they chose very little. They took very little. I said, but don't you want more? And he said, well, lady, I have no house, I have no home, you know, what shall I do with all this stuff? I have to carry it around. I said, oh, no. You know, this whole thing is like, that's the advantage also, having no house, you don't want much, because it's a drag to carry it around. Then so I asked him, I said, do you know anywhere else? I said, where are you mates? Where are your people there? And he said, maybe they're at the shelter, because it was, you know, food-giving time. So we went down there, and sure enough, there was a lot of them. And so what I did, because I had kind of, I've seen the joy in his eyes, being able to choose, and not being given. Because those people, we choose for them, and we give. They have no choice. Yeah. Of course, also joy, you know, there's always, we are in samsara, so whatever you hear, there's always a drawback. That's what samsara is all about. Of course, choice also makes you unfree. Yeah? Choice makes your mind very confused. Choice makes you attached. But still, it's like, But that's not the point here. The point here was that he felt respected. He felt like equal to other beings who can choose. Free America, we have choices. They're no good, it's true, on an ultimate level. They make us actually unfree. Yeah? Because it takes a lot of time. You have to choose the right thing, because there is no right thing anyway. We always want to find the best quality for the lowest price. It doesn't exist. It just takes up a lot of our time. So then I thought, well, I just put the bags there for them to choose. And it was such an amazing experience. They were so happy. Mm-hmm. It was like, whatever. And then they usually don't like chocolate because their teeth are very bad. But then when they eat two things, it hurts. They have holes in the teeth. So nobody really wanted the chocolate. So I said, don't you have anybody who likes chocolate around here? So that somebody said, yes, I know somebody. And he went to get her. So I gave her the old bag, which was at least 2 kilos or something like that. But then she can distribute it. Which then means she could eat it. It was like completely up to her. I didn't say, but share it with others. Yeah. So I left it completely up to her, as people leave it up to me with my position, what I want to do with it, whether I want to share it or whether I want to keep it. Whether she wants to keep it, she can keep it. Whether she wants to distribute it, she would probably distribute it because nobody can eat 2 kilos of chocolate. So then you give them the opportunity to create merit by being generous, which then cuts through the karma of poverty. So this is skillful, you see. As long as they don't have anything, they cannot cut through the karma of being poor. Us giving them an abundance, they can cut through that. Or us needing something. At one point we went on alms round. You know, sometimes, especially the Theravada monks, they go on alms round with their begging bowls. And somebody in a Vietnamese monk in Bulgaria said, you know, we should go and call Pindapat, should go on alms round. And that's that kind of, I didn't say like this, but in my mind it said, are you crazy? You know, in this the poorest state of India, Bihar, right? And I get fed at the center. And I said, you think I'm going to take the food away from those people? I didn't say that. I thought it. I didn't actually expect to say something like that, so I didn't produce some negativity in my speech. But still with my mind. So, but I kind of said, oh, well, you know, I'm not sure. Very politely. I'm not sure. People are very poor. And, you know, we can have food at the center. So if you want to come with us, we can get you to... And he looked at me and he shook his head and kind of said, Anila, how are those people ever going to finish their time of being hungry ghosts if we don't go out and allow them to practice their rest? And I thought, oh, that's how it is. So of course, and I agreed. Yeah. And when I agreed, I also saw it was my pride that didn't want to go. I didn't want to go barefoot with the begging bowl from house to house. Like underneath that thing, no, I don't want to take the food away from them. Was that thing? I don't want to take their food. I have better food at the center, which is an absolutely no-go thought for a monk or a nun. You should be dependent on the lay community, you know, and accept, learning to accept whatever you are given. And it was so touching because people were so happy. You know, they give you not much. You know, just one plate of rice and they give a handful. So you're not really taking anything away from them. But it made them happy to be able to give, the same way as we are happy when we can give. So I see. So maybe ask the homeless people for some, not for money, but for some help, maybe, you know. Ask them for a street, or ask them for, I don't know, help you with your bags, or something like that, I don't know. Make contact with them. Yeah. This could be practicing six perfections. Practicing bodhicitta. Training the mind to be equanimous. Not being afraid of unsavory people. Because once you lose your fear from them, then you see much deeper. And you see they're just ordinary suffering human being. And then your heart opens. And when your heart opens, you can actually, then the fact of wisdom starts to operate. Yeah? And understands on a very deep level, there's nothing I can do to help them. Like actively. But I can still have an open heart towards them. And then you can smile at them. The big responsibility that you have to help them actively is off your shoulders. And you can speak to them in a very relaxed way. Like when they approach you. Yesterday we went on the cable car boat with the Tibetan man. They were standing in the queue and the man just like this one. You know? And you can have a normal conversation with them. If they still, you know, lucid enough to get it. Yeah. Or make a joke or something like that in a relaxed way. No guilt behind, you know. Kind of having a very clear mind, I'm not going to give you money, but I will give you an open heart, a connection, human to human. Sometimes actually I do give them money when I have a lot of changes. Things that keep the changes and, you know, slowly it's not just, you know, they're not 1 cent. What can they do with 1 cent? And they feel very, very generous, you know, having given them 1 cent. So, I understand. I probably would do the same. You know, it's like, it's a bit, what should I do with this? It's like, come on. Yeah. And we expect gratitude, isn't it? Yeah. So, okay, we shouldn't get upset when they throw away the pen. Huh? Oh, that, wait a minute, the microphone.
Like, plug for the merit box?
Yeah, right. If you have pennies, yeah, put them in the merit box. That's okay. Merit box won't spit it up. So like that. So then you're not so, you know, you're not so afraid of them anymore. Try to make them laugh. Try to make them feel somehow accepted. Yeah. Yeah. Microphone.
I wrote a poem about it yesterday. Mm-hmm. Can I share it with you? Mm-hmm.
I'll make it like 50 years.
Nope. I saw the Buddha today and I didn't feed her. I asked myself why. Why didn't I? She was disappointed with my dollar that took me so long to dig out of my bag. Why didn't I give her two? Because I only give the homeless one. I thought of the dollar and sent her blessing. I even thought, maybe I'll give her lunch. But then my friend arrived, and I forgot. There was food in my bag, a muffin, a plum, and a bag of chips. It would have been so very easy to feed her. Why? Why didn't I?
See, it's enough at the beginning just to think, right? Because then we see. Because we need to see the reason why. Right? Because if you don't see that reason why, we will not give in the right way. You know? Because we can't see their suffering, because we can't relate to them. We don't see that we're actually in the same boat as them. You know? It's always kind of, this could never happen to me now. So, from the Mahayana point of view, like all beings have been our mothers, you know? So you train to see all beings that you have having been your mothers. So can you react? Can you imagine how you would react if you see your mother sitting in this tree like this? Or your brother, sister, father, son, daughter. You know, I have quite a lot of friends, and not at all, but some of my friends, their sons are brothers. And they know that, of course, the heart, you see the thing is now, they understand that giving them money is not helping, but their heart would want to give them whatever they need. So this is the attitude that we have to create. Our heart is not open. An open heart gives whatever, doesn't think. You know? We think too quickly. First we have to open the heart and then think, is it a benefit or not? If we just think with the closed heart, the closed heart will always say, no, not a benefit. No time, doesn't help them, it's just a plum. But the plum given with kindness. You know, even actually, again, allowing her to have a choice, saying, look, I have this, would you like to have it? not just he had taken, then when he comes flying back, he did it sick. Because then if the person says no, then okay, you offer. And you walk away and you feel okay because you offer. Yeah. Sometimes, and I know maybe I shouldn't say that, I know it's not good. You know, there's it actually would be against the principles of generosity. Like generosity is giving the right thing at the right time to the right person. So giving money to a drug addict is not a good thing. It's not the right thing because they do. But I was an alcoholic myself. Not in the doctor, not in the street. I think I told you, yeah, I was very snobbish. I had a lot of money. So I could, you know, allow myself to drink all those very expensive things. But who knows how long this would have lasted until you're so far gone that you lose it and you lose your business, you know, or you don't care about your business anymore, and then you drop there also. You know. So I can kind of see myself sitting there. I see that I didn't want, you know, nobody wants to become an alcoholic. It's nobody's intention to become an alcoholic. Right? But that's just, you know, how you end up there. So now again, coming back to practicing like your hair is on fire. Maybe first you have to see where does this term come from. So it's from the 37 practices of a bodhisattva. And one verse says, even the ones who want to become arhats. Arhats means you want to become an arhat means you want to just finish your own suffering. Yeah, that's the Theravadin kind of principle, self-liberation. Which is great because, you know, even though you don't think about the others, but you have understood that there is no happiness, the kind of happiness that you want. You have understood, at least for yourself, that there's no happiness in this samsara here. Yeah. And as you're getting yourself out of samsara, at least you rid the world of your present. So there's one person less to feed. There's one person less who walks on ants and kills them. There's one person less who pollutes the, you know, who needs a shower and heating and air conditioning and this and that in the world. There's one person less. So that's a good thing. Never ever denigrate these like, oh, they're just rotten, they're so selfish, whatever. Because what happens with us sometimes, because we jump to the Mahayana principles, but we don't think about ourselves. We haven't understood our own suffering yet. So there's no renunciation. Then there's no, the practice is not strong enough because there is no renunciation. You cannot have compassion for others if you don't have compassion for yourself. And compassion for yourself, what does that mean? It's like there's this very strong wish, I want to get out of here as quickly as possible. So, the verse comes from there. Even somebody who wants to become an arhat has to practice as if his hair would be on fire. Then what about the Mahayana? You know, if those people have such an intensity of practice, but what about the Mahayana people? What about the Bodhisattva people? You know, then even more so. But as long as we haven't understood our own suffering and we just think, oh, it's just the poor guys in the street who suffer, and I'm okay, then, you know, there is no effort. The effort that we have to make is too heavy. If there's absolutely no interest for somebody to climb a mountain, climb rock climbing, that would be like a punishment almost, you know. If people like rock climbing, I also did that, not when I was an alcoholic, that was different. I did different things in my life. I'm a bit extreme, I tend to fall from one extreme to the other. That's probably why it was easy to become a nun, for my parents, let's say, because I was so extreme all the time. So that would be punishment, whereas if you want to go on top of the mountain, it's pleasure, even though it's painful. So Dharma practice is painful. Why? Because you have to sacrifice the things that give you short-term pleasure. But if you climb a mountain, you sacrifice the short-term pleasure of lying on a beach. in the sun and get a suntan. While you climb the mountain, you get, you know, you kind of, one thing is you have to be mindful. Lying on the beach, you don't have to be mindful. Your thoughts go here and there, and it's very dissatisfying, lying on the beach, you know, spending your whole day like this. And the sun is no good for you, by the way. Okay? I guess by now everybody's understood that. Not just for the skin, it's also for the inner organs, because it's very bad for the liver, especially if you're in the sun between 2 and 4 in the afternoon. So if your kids go to the swimming pool and then come back grumpy, then you know why. Grumpy and angry and impatient. Because it's not good to be out in the sun. Especially then because it affects the liver and the kidneys from the time. Right. So we have to give up short-term pleasures. Of course it's much more easy to lie on a beach. It's boring. Whereas climbing a mountain, it makes you fit, makes the body fit, gives you tremendous self-confidence, yeah, because you have to overcome your fear, yeah, so then you get courage and you feel good about yourself. And it's quite an elating, kind of, you know, when you're down again and you look up and wow, this is sort of thing. But still, it's not satisfying. I don't know, any of you do things like that? Okay. So, it's okay, keep doing it, but observe, you know, and I only kind of saw that, how that goes, once I started meditating practice. Now, because we do both together, I had kind of already, more or less, I thought, given up finally. Detachment is still there, but only if I'm somewhere in the mountain. Down here, it's okay. I'm okay, I can live without it completely. So, once you're up, you're waiting for it. You're waiting for something more intense to happen. The feeling of, wow, and you don't want to go down. And on the way down, you're already planning the next trip. It's Spider-Man. And it's good to see that and have some humans say, hey, look, you know, it's just been up there. So like that. Yeah. And then to see that, it doesn't give us what we want. It doesn't give us a feeling that is intense, and it doesn't give us satisfaction, basically. Or if you're satisfied, it's because you're tired, but that's not real satisfaction. You would be really satisfied from climbing that mountain, you wouldn't climb the next trip. Or like that. But it's a great practice, because one thing is you're forced to be mindful. And then when you're forced to be mindful, like the effort comes because you have to, otherwise you fall. Then it's quite easy to be mindful. The mind stays on your hands and on your feet. Yeah? Your full attention is completely there. Once you're in the present, you're peaceful. Even if it's dangerous and even if there's pain. And the pain is not, it's just pain. Not bad. Yeah? It's just pain. So the pain that we have in our Dharma practice, we don't see it like that. It should not be there because we don't expect it. If you go and climb a mountain and you don't expect that it will be painful, you'll give up very, very quickly. So we practice because we want to attain a state which is free from suffering. But then we think that this state free of suffering should already come in the practice. It's not like that. Practice is like the cure, yeah, for our sicknesses. And the problem is we expect the cure to be easy and painless. And if it's not, we're surprised. Because why? Because we want short-term happiness. Our mind practices, our practice, like you get used to your practice and then it does it automatically. So what we do automatically is getting happiness now. So then we do the practices, the frustrations, the mantras, and this and that. And of course, sometimes you have a very happy feeling, it's true. Yeah. But sometimes you're not focused, you're not inspired, it's a big drag, it's like, I think that says it all, that's how it is. You don't need many words, it's just like, it's heavy, you know? And then we don't understand, where is that kind of happiness that I expect the practice to give me? We don't expect problems and hindrances in the past, because we haven't started at the beginning properly. We don't embark on the path properly. Or we like the patient who says, yeah, I want to be cured, and I will take the medicine, but the medicine has to be sweet. Now that's the start of the path, by realizing that we are sick. Maybe those who study Lamun Chemo, anybody who studies Lamun Chemo? The big Lamun, one of the couples Lamun Chemo, you never know? Yeah, Lamun Chemo, it's like, it's every path to enlightenment is like in the Gelug tradition, is like long rim, but there is like short ones, like the foundation of all good qualities, the short one, and it's the middling length, long rim, and then it's the long length. Of course, to be obvious, the long one has more detail. So in the long one, at right at the beginning, after the, you know, like saying where the chickens come from, like fish and anything like that, right at the beginning, before even you go into Buddha devotion and Christian rebirth, come what is called the six attitudes. Now what is an attitude? It's a mental factor, right? Attitude is a mental factor. And if one has an attitude, that mental factor directs you into that direction. If we don't have the attitude, we're not going there. Or if we want to go there, it's a big struggle. The moment you have the attitude, it will make you go there. Or vision. Frankly, now these days when you want to get a new job, it's like people ask you, what's your vision? Or you come with a project, what's your vision? They like you. Actually, it would be quite... I wonder how people would react when you would just say, less unhappiness, less suffering, that's my vision. I wonder what people would say. And on top of it, if you would say, less unhappiness, less suffering for me and for others, that's my vision. Would you employ somebody like that? Because, of course, if they say, oh, less unhappiness just for myself, I wouldn't want this person working for me, because then they would just kick and fly and whatever, you know. That's the thing, if we're just concerned with our own happiness now, that's why we create all those negativity. Whereas if we have this very, very broad mind, less unhappiness, less suffering for myself and others, then that vision is very big. And you see, the bigger the vision, the more effort you can make. The higher your mountain you want to climb, you know it's difficult. But it's so easy to put more effort into it. If you just climb a hill, you know, not much effort. And unfortunately, we're very, very frugal with our effort. We don't see that when you make effort, and at the moment I know it's pushing effort, but if you do make effort with the right attitude, and this is what to make effort with the right attitude, it gives us energy. You can, it's very simple to see if you do longer just mindfulness meditation, if you decide for, you know, for one session that you will keep the mind there and bring it back, a very, very, very strong determination. We can't do it in every session because otherwise we get too tired, too tense a little bit. But one, just, you know, or maybe just 5 minutes, all of a sudden you feel that gives you a lot of energy, making effort. But underneath the effort has to be the faith or the attitude or the aspiration or whatever you want to call it. Anybody knows what those six attitudes are? Microphone? Anybody? Okay. Thank you, Paul.
Joyful effort?
No, that's one of the six perfections. That's okay, you haven't failed yet. You can still stay here. You're not going to be sent out to the outside to wait in front of the door and feel ashamed and guilty and whatever.
Perhaps one, it's an attitude of yourself as a patient and the Dharma as the medicine.
That's the attitude. Good. Doesn't mean that you're bad. Yeah, if he's good, we can, not relative. Yeah, so exactly. So, but this has to be meditated upon. You know, he said, are we, when you came this morning, he included, did you see yourself as a patient? This attitude is not there. And as long as this attitude is not there, effort comes very, very difficult. So now we'll maybe have a little break. Do you have break? Maybe just a pee-pee break? You need a pee-pee break, or you want to do the meditation first? Great. Where is the effort? Okay, great. Because, yeah, and then we'll try to see where, why we are sick. Where is, what kind of patients are we? Where is the sickness? And we see that, if we understand that sickness concept. Try to be maybe not too chattering in the breaks, because otherwise you lose the energy that we have created, because we were very focused, it's great. By being focused, one creates energy also, then one goes into chatting, scatters. So if you need to go to the toilet, just go to the toilet. If you need to just stretch your legs, maybe walk a little bit up and down. Stop the computer, does it stop the computer?